Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Welcome to Atlanta's Olympic Stadium for the opening ceremony of these centennial Olympic Games.
How do you want your heroes? Do you envision square-jawed men with movie star good looks from the 1950s, a steady voice projecting training and confidence? Could that someone be not white or not male or not fit? What about jowly and paunchy? What about not particularly successful, socially awkward? Go back to 1996 and the Atlanta Olympic bombings. No one was giving Richard Jewell the benefit of that doubt. Certainly not the FBI, not the press. You just heard the voice of Bob Costas, then NBC's chief Olympics host, as Jewell came under suspicion for the bombings, publicly. Costas reminded viewers that everyone was presumed innocent until proven guilty. For 88 days that summer, few other Americans gave Richard Jewell the benefit of that doubt. A part-time private security guard with a weight problem and a desire to get a real police badge, he seemed more likely to be the wannabe hero-turned-bomber than an actual hero who alertly risked his life to save others. This hour, On Point, a new movie from Clint Eastwood and a new book seek to set the record straight, to capture the real Richard Jewell and the ordeal he endured. Join us for our listeners who are watching at home, and especially for those who were in Atlanta during the summer of 1996. What are your memories of the 96 Atlanta Olympics bombing? What do you think of when you hear Richard Jewell's name? What do you think of the media coverage in retrospect? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With us today are the co-authors of a new and seemingly definitive book on the bombing. It's called The Suspect, An Olympic Bombing, the FBI, the Media, and Richard Jewell, the Man Caught in the Middle. The book is also a source of inspiration for a new Clint Eastwood movie out next weekend called simply Richard Jewell. Both of my guests were consultants on the film. From Stanford, California, we would like to welcome Kevin Salwin. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter and editor who ran the paper's Southeastern section during the 1996 Olympics. Kevin, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you.
And from Atlanta, Georgia, we are joined by Kent Alexander. He was former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia during the 1996 Olympics, which means he was the chief federal prosecutor for Atlanta. And he is, in fact, a character in this drama as well as a co-author of that book. You can hello, Kent, to you.
Thanks, David. Hi.
And I also want to tell listeners you can find an excerpt of The Suspect at our website, onpointradio.org. So let's turn back the clock a little bit. And get people into the mindset. First, I do want to play a brief clip of the motion picture Richard Jewell. It's still directed by Clint Eastwood, as I mentioned. It opens later this month. Among its stars are the actors John Hamm, Sam Rockwell, and Olivia Wilde. Here's a snippet from the trailer.
Richard, you're a national hero now.
Thank you, sir. But I was just doing my job.
Move away from the town!
You always look at the guy who found the bomb just like you always look at the guy who found the body.
Jewell fits the profile of the lone bomber.
A frustrated white man who is a police wannabe who seeks to become a hero.
That is the recreation of Richard Jewell. Now, to set the stone at scene, I do want you to hear the voice of the man himself. On October 28, 1996, Richard Jewell held a news conference in Atlanta shortly after his name was cleared.
This is the first time I have ever asked you to turn your cameras on me. For 88 days, I lived a nightmare. For 88 days, my mother lived a nightmare too. And it's rushed for the headline that the hero was the bomber. The media cared nothing for my feelings as a human being.
So Ken Alexander, I wanted listeners to have his voice in their heads as we go back and then build right back up. We go back to before the bombing and then build up to Richard Jewell's exoneration. In which you played a direct role, of course. But talk to us a little bit about Centennial Park, about the aspirations of Atlanta, and about the fears that people like you and law enforcement had for the games as they embarked on this event on the world stage.
Sure. Well, as an Atlanta native, I took huge pride in the Olympics coming to the city, as everybody did. And there was just phenomenal excitement. When I came on as U.S. attorney in 1994, I spent literally the next couple of years working with law enforcement on security planning for the Olympics, because during the course of that time, there was the Oklahoma City bombing. You had Waco and Ruby Ridge. You had the first World Trade Center bombing. So there's a real concern about what might happen at the park. So we spent a lot of time on security. When the Olympics were being planned, there were a lot of new venues being built. But Billy Payne, really the dreamer who came up with the wonderful idea of bringing the Games to Atlanta, envisioned having a kind of a town square, just a place open to everybody, that turned into Centennial Olympic Park. And it was the largest new urban park in America in recent times. And it was, as he envisioned, open to the public, and it was wonderful. Sound stages, tents, pavilions, it was a great place to be. The problem was, at the end, it became a soft target, as we called it in law enforcement, because other venues had magnetometers and a lot of armed security guards. This one had people undercover. So just building up to the point when Richard Jewell became involved, the park was a phenomenal success. We were 9 days into the Olympics. 50,000 people were showing up at night, jamming into the park, and it was just a wonderful big gala until it wasn't.
Until it wasn't. If you could, Kevin Solwin, tell us from a journalistic standpoint, when did you first hear that there had been a bombing, and what was your response?
Well, my personal experience was that I didn't actually hear until the next morning. I had been in the park that night, but I had small children and I had left. You know, as Kent said, the park was just a nightly party. It was spectacular. There was always music playing, that kind of thing. And I had taken my children home, and it wasn't until the next morning when I got a phone call that said, hey, there was an explosion in the park last night, and one person was killed, and a second person died on the way to film it, a Turkish cameraman. And now all of a sudden, the Olympic Games, which are this just spectacular, it's, you know, to set the scene, it's the largest peacetime event in history. 197 nations are invited. Every single one of them sends a team of athletes and coaches. There are 2 million tickets sold. There is tremendous television ratings. There's 15,000 journalists in town to cover this. And then this all spins out of control in that one overnight incident.
Well, we're going to talk after the break and through the show about the roles of federal investigators at the FBI and also the media in all this. But Kevin, I do want to ask us, before the night, that summer night, before that event, who would you have described to me Richard Jewell as being? How would you have characterized him to me?
Richard Jewell was he was a quirky, entertaining, very gregarious local policeman. In your intro, you said he was kind of a wannabe cop. Well, actually, Richard Jewell was a licensed law enforcement officer of the state of Georgia. He had broken into law enforcement 5 years earlier. He worked for the Habersham County Sheriff's Office, which was about 75 miles north of Atlanta. He had a horrific driving record that helped get him essentially fired from that job. He got demoted, and then he decided to quit. After that, he had worked as a campus police officer at a small college not far from there. And again, he was too zealous. He was essentially fired from that job. So he had come to Atlanta. He was living with his mother, which comes into play, and decided to get a job in security working at the park just to bridge until law enforcement departments were hiring again, and then he was going to look for another job.
And so how important, Ken Alexander, was the fact that Richard Jewell had this essentially, I think, minimum wage job, one that with of a specific duration, but nonetheless of this high profile nature, alongside police from Georgia Bureau of Investigations, the FBI, ATF, and other type of law enforcement officials.
How was it before the Olympics, or
how important was it to him that he had this?
It was hugely important to him. This was his pride and joy. He felt like every fiber in his body was designed to be a law enforcement officer. So he took his job really seriously. It was many people said to Kevin and me as we interviewed 180 or so folks that he basically ate, slept, and breathed law enforcement. In fact, a couple of his bosses, both at Habersham and at Piedmont College, were a little concerned that he was almost too into his job.
And so let's just take a brief moment. We only got a couple minutes before this first break. Mm-hmm. But what does he do? He sees a backpack under a bench near one of the towers where people are sort of surveying and doing other things and creating the entertainment. What does he do when he spots that?
He spots the pack and he flags down or turns to a guy named Tom Davis, a Georgia Bureau Investigation agent, GBI agent, and says that shouldn't be there. Some guys must have left this. The two of them check around. They can't find anybody. And so Richard Jewell turns to Tom Davis and said, what are we going to do about this situation? Grabbing his vest. And Tom Davis is saying, what situation? There have been so many packages left behind, suspicious packages. But Tom Davis follows protocol and then sets in a series of steps where law enforcement comes to take a look at what exactly is under that bench, and things unfolded from there.
Richard Jewell was hailed as a hero at that time. I'd like to play a brief word from the man who was then president of the United States. A day after the Olympic bombing, President Clinton spoke from the White House to praise those charged with keeping the Olympics safe.
I want to thank the brave security personnel who were on the scene. They saw the package. They alerted the bomb squad. They cleared the crowd. They prevented a much greater loss of life.
That package was actually designed to kill. One woman was fatally wounded at that time. A cameraman from abroad had a fatal heart attack in rushing to try to cover the event. More than 100 other people were injured. Richard Jewell acted to help save lives. We'll hear about what he did and what he was then believed to have done after this break. We're discussing the life and significance of Richard Jewell, the man wrongly under suspicion as the person responsible for those fatal bombings at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics and whose life was forever changed as a result. Join our conversation about Richard Jewell, about the federal investigation, the press, and the man really behind the string of deadly bombings. We're joined by the co-authors of a new, meticulously researched book that shifts our understanding of what took place. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking back a generation to the bombing of the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta and the man caught in the middle, Richard Jewell. That's the subject of a new book. The book's co-authors are with me today. You can join our conversation. For people of Atlanta and people visiting the Olympics at that time, what was the legacy of those games for you? What do you remember about Richard Jewell and what he endured? What of the coverage by the hometown Atlanta Journal-Constitution and national outlets, including NBC? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With us, Kevin Salwin. He's former Wall Street Journal reporter and editor. He is co-author of that new book called The Suspect, and his co-author, Kent Alexander, former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia at the time of the 1996 Olympics. I want to briefly take a couple of your quick calls, your quick remembrances. From Kittery, Maine, Darlene is calling in. Darlene, what do you recall of this time?
Hi, how do you do? Thank you for taking my call. I remember that day very well and very vividly. I have very close ties to Atlanta, and my best friend was visiting me in California from Atlanta, and we were camping, and we got up to the next morning to go out to breakfast to find that there was a bombing in Atlanta that night, the night previous, and we were unable to get in touch with friends and family, and it was an excruciating couple of hours until we got in touch with friends because they were at that event the night before. And I tell you, every time I go back to Atlanta and we visit that area, it is creepy, to say the least.
To go down near Centennial Park.
Yes, it is. It's a beautiful place, but you can feel it was kind of a stain on the area of something that was meant to be really beautiful and turned out to be really bad. So.
Well, thank you for that, Darlene. Ken Alexander, you're a native Georgian. You're from Atlanta. What is your reaction to, just visceral reaction, when you go by Centennial Park now?
It's changed over time. My visceral reaction used to be exactly like Darlene's. It was just painful to see, especially this fan-shaped Greek sculpture that's there that still has shrapnel in it. But as time's gone on, and the park has gone through different metamorphoses, and it's a fun place, a lot of huge events. The only time I really have had a visceral reaction again is when I was down one night and they had 4th of July fireworks, and I just can't be there for 4th of July fireworks, but I really like the park otherwise.
I'd like to take a call now also from Greenville, Georgia. Ben, thanks for listening and calling in.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
While I was not involved with the Atlanta, when it actually happened, I have since lived in the areas where Mr. Jewell was from. And I think what would have been helpful to the people that were putting together profiles was to understand those folks, because when you're talking about Meriwether County and also the area where Mr. Jewell was from, not a lot of job opportunities, but a very earnest group of people, and whenever they're into something, they are really into it. And that probably would have been very beneficial to the people that had made judgments about Mr. Jewell at the time period. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation.
So glad you did, Ben. Thanks for calling in. Kevin Sullivan, let's talk a little bit about how Richard Jewell, who had brought the backpack to the attention of other law enforcement officials. They tried to, get equipment in to essentially defuse the machine. Tried to get people out, even at times kind of hollering at them to get away, to take it seriously. How did he swing into view as a suspect among so many other possible people for the chief investigators for the FBI, for Don Johnson, who is a key figure in this saga?
Right. Richard appeared on several CNN interviews. It was found out that he was the person who had located the pack. And so AT&T, who was his employer, helped to broker some interviews that he did on, as I said, CNN. He did some newspaper interviews with USA Today and the Boston Globe and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And then on the Tuesday morning, so essentially 2 days after the bombing, he goes on the Today Show with Katie Couric, and she refers to him as a hero. And he gives, essentially the response that he was absolutely conditioned to do, which is that the real heroes were the law enforcement who helped push away the crowd and save lives. And what he doesn't know is that as he's leaving that interview and as he's leaving the park, he is being tailed by the FBI. And Kent, do you want to talk a little bit about what's going on in Quantico?
Yeah, so in Quantico, there's a behavioral science unit. It was called actually something else at the time, but BSU is what we still called it. And they got word of about Richard Jewell, and they took a look at these videos from CNN. And this is the group that was featured in Silence of the Lambs with Jodie Foster. So they decided to take a close look at him at Atlanta's urging, because as Kevin may have said earlier, you always take a look at the person who found the bomb. So they looked, and they issued a report that was 4 pages long, single-spaced. We found it through another source. I hadn't seen it in 23 years, but I recognized it immediately, and it was two parts. The first part was interview advice on how to actually interview Richard Jewell, and there was a there was an interview A that was a soft interview, and there was to be an interview B, which was a hard-hitting interview days later. And the interviews both were at least a day or two off. The second part of it was a profile not of a generic bomber, as reported in the press at the time and since, but it was really a profile of Richard Jewell and why he was likely the bomber. And even though there was some disclaimer language, it effectively painted him as the bomber.
Can I just read from that for a moment, Kent?
Sure.
Here in chapter 12, you publish from this. And let me just say to listeners, this is meticulously constructed. You guys are drawing from 302 documents, which are these clearly the raw interviews that the agents have done and videotapes from all kinds of different players, contemporaneous. I think your own journals, those of the actual killer who we'll talk about later. Folks, this is a really detailed thing. But in this is the profile of Richard Jewell. And it says, Jewell is a, quote, wannabe cop, unquote. He also gives every indication of suffering an inadequate personality and requires the trappings of a law enforcement officer, badge, uniform, etc. to command respect. Unfortunately for him, he has lost his jobs in law enforcement, therefore is without those things which he needs to feel like a complete man. And then they say basically, what better way to become a hero? The bigger the threat, the bigger the hero. Discovery of a hoax device would not even be newsworthy. Imagining what a hero he would be if the device was discovered and disarmed, the media would be reporting that the device would have killed and wounded scores had it not been for the heroics of Richard Jewell. This is a very damning profile. This feels like an indictment and conviction all in the same page.
It was extraordinary. And I will say the behavioral science folks at Quantico have helped solve some amazing crimes. And it's always a tool for an investigation. It's not evidence. But that profile played an oversized role in driving the investigation. And the description you just read, which is very damning, in part matched up with independent interviews being conducted in the North Georgia area that your earlier caller had referenced, where people said that, oh, Richard Jewell's a wannabe cop. He was a little overzealous, this, that, the other. And that those two, the confluence of the interviews and what was said in the profile came together. And it was it just spun out of control from there. There was an assumption, really, that Richard Jewell was the guy. Even though there had been two suspects before Richard Jewell, everything at that point shifted to Richard.
I want to take a quick call from Omaha, Nebraska. John, thank you for listening. Share your thoughts on this.
Hi. As I saw on your screener, was a police officer then and was one of 2,000 police officers that worked at the Olympics. There were 60% of us were from the United States, 40% from all of the countries around. And my particular job is I oversaw security at the tennis venue at Stone Mountain during the daytime shifts. And each one of the police officers there, sworn police officers, had three or four what we call civilian securities assigned to them. So it was a large security presence. Those people did wonderful jobs. We were dealing with a lot of crowds. But I guess my point was, is after the bomb went off, I wasn't at the park. I was at the dormitory at Athens. And I had headphones on. I was actually sleeping, but they said a bomb went off, and I immediately woke up. But as I said, from then on, the whole Olympics, it was too bad because it changed. We were serious in our work. It was fun. We were having, enjoying meeting the people. But after the day after that bomb, it got real serious, and people just weren't it didn't seem like people were having a lot of – they were having fun. They wanted to be there. But it took on a whole different tone, and it was really too bad. And I was actually sad for the United States.
John, can I ask you one quick question before I let you go, which is I'm going to talk with our guests a little bit about the publication and disclosure that he was a suspect from the feds. But just from your own standpoint as somebody who retired police officer, somebody working security there, when – that became news when that shows up in the AJC, the Journal Constitution Atlanta, or on CNN or other networks. Did you initially respond with anger at him? Were you responding in sort of indignance that one of your own would be accused? How did it hit you when that was disclosed?
Well, it was interesting. In 1991, I attended the National FBI Academy. I actually took a course in one of the behavioral science units. I took a course down there. And the other gentleman I was down there with, we were talking about this. And funnily enough, we both said, well, we just wanted them to get it right. I didn't have a feeling, I don't think, one way or another. But if it was him, I think we all just wanted him to get it right. And it's a hard job to do, and you have to go where your evidence is taking you. But I didn't feel one way or another about him.
All right. Well, thank you for that, John. I want to turn back to you guys, my co-authors on this, but the co-authors on this book. I sure didn't put in the years on this. To talk a little bit about that, there seemed to be a breakdown here where Kevin Saltwin, there was a reliance, as you guys report, on the profile not only to inform who to interview but to sort of determine that the interview should find him conclusive guilt, evidence of his guilt. That is, it was predetermined not who to talk, just who to talk to, but who to – you should try to get the indictment on. And secondly, it seemed as though the FBI acted, or at least the FBI in the form of Don Johnson, who was leading the interrogation of Richard Jewell, ultimately ended up misleading him and doing so in a way that raised concerns at the highest levels of the Justice Department and the FBI.
Let me toss that one over to Kent, because he really was the guy who was inside
sure.
all the FBI rooms.
All right. Well, Kent, this is your institution, this guy who works essentially as your investigators, right? You're the chief U.S. prosecutor for Northern District of Georgia. Your guy ultimately acted in ways that you wouldn't really want to have to defend publicly, it seems to me.
You're correct. And in fact, when I heard the tape, let me back up. You had said earlier that Richard Jewell was wrongly under suspicion. And just to clarify a bit, there were a lot of things that suggested he should be looked at. So the FBI absolutely should have looked at him. But some of the things done along the way, and I think first and foremost, that interview and the way it happened were just wrong. So in that instance, the FBI agent was bringing Richard Jewell in. The story in the Atlanta newspaper, the AJC, was breaking that Richard Jewell was the suspect. There had been a leak out of law enforcement, which side comment is inexcusable, but there had been a leak. So the story was coming out. The interview was rushed. The profile had laid out this two-step interview process. The FBI shifted to Plan B. Richard Jewell was brought in on the pretext that it was a training video. And I know that people find that really offensive to have a pretext in something like this. But at the time, people thought Richard Jewell was actually the bomber. And just like with the DEA, when they have drug dealers pose or agents pose as drug dealers, here they were just trying to get him in to speak. So though it doesn't look good, the worst part wasn't really that. The worst part was the issuance of Miranda rights, because Richard Jewell is
– and let's get to that in a moment. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Ken Alexander, tell us briefly about the Miranda rights question. That is, you know, the right that we hear in Law and Order all the time, right?
Yeah, right to an attorney, right to remain silent, all of that. In this instance, Richard Jewell's on the fourth floor of the FBI. The agents are questioning him. A camera's rolling. I'm down the hall along with the head of the FBI office and a few others. Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI, and Merrick Garland from the Justice Department are in Washington with others, and we're all on the phone. A call comes in, and the director, Louis Freeh, says, interrupt the interview, read him his rights. And mind you, at that point, the thinking in Washington and Atlanta was Richard Jewell was likely the bomber based on this profile and some other evidence that came in. So it's hard to say whether that was really out of concern for Richard Jewell or whether it was more to preserve what he said to be used later. Either way, there was a knock on the door where Richard Jewell was with the agents. One agent came out. He was told, read them the rights. They took a break in the interview. Both agents came out. Don Johnson was apoplectic. That's actually never done. You just don't interrupt an interview if somebody's not under arrest, not in custody, because that's when you have Miranda rights read, when you're in custody. But he went back in, and there was no live feed to the outside. Nobody on the outside, including me, outside of that room, knew there was a pretext, knew there was a ruse, a training video. And certainly nobody listened to how those rights were delivered. And the way they were delivered, and we try to write this all in a kind of suspenseful, novel-like way. It's, I hope it reads a little like a novel, but it's just it's the truth. And the, what ended up happening is Don Johnson said something to the effect, we're going to treat this like it's a real interview. And then he goes on to read the rights, and a light bulb goes off, and it's quite a moment in the when Richard Jewell realizes he's not being interviewed for a training video. He's not for first responders. He's the suspect. And at that point, he asked for an attorney.
It really is, Ken Alexander, a moment, as there are many moments in this book, where you realize that, I mean, I felt some sympathy for Don Johnson being interrupted by his boss's 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 boss and told exactly what he could and couldn't do. And at the same time, for Richard Jewell, you know, the stakes are supreme. And the deception that was attempted there seemed to me pretty stark, starkly against the spirit and rules that had been set up to protect suspects who nonetheless are entitled to the presumption of innocence. So we're going to ask you guys to hold on. We're speaking with the authors of this new book out about Richard Jewell and the legacy of the 1996 bombing at the Atlanta Olympics. It's called The Suspect. You can join our conversation. Who do you blame for what went wrong? The feds, the press, something else? We're going to talk a little bit about the media's role and its decision to publish Richard Jewell's name. What are the lessons of his ordeal? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're turning the clock back to 1996, when a bomb wreaked havoc on the Atlanta Olympics, killing one, leading to the death of another, injuring more than 100 people additionally, and upending the life of security guard Richard Jewell. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for my guests? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With us, the co-authors of a new book about Richard Jewell called The Suspect. Kevin Solwin is former Wall Street Journal reporter and editor. He joined us from California. And with us from Atlanta, Kent Alexander, former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia at the time of the 1996 Olympics. They're also consultants on the new Clint Eastwood movie coming out next week called Richard Jewell. I want to take a few calls to start this segment to help inform our conversation as it goes forward. First, I want to take a call from Jack. He's calling from Decatur, Georgia. Thanks for calling in, Jack.
Hey, how's everybody doing today? Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
In 96, my wife, my son was 6 years old. We lived in the Atlanta suburbs in Snellville, and we loved the park. We came in virtually every night, and we're in the park the night of the bombing. We had just left. We had seen the great Cajun band Beausoleil, had a really wonderful time, and heard about the explosion on the way home on the radio news. Pretty upsetting. But the thing that amazed me was several years later, I came home from work one night and found a kind of an official-looking document taped to my front door. It was from a BATF agent, and they wanted to talk to me. And I did talk to them. I didn't have much to say to them. But the thoroughness of it all amazed me. I realized that they had contacted me because I'd used an ATM in the park that night.
The lengths still go to try to nail that down, and because, of course, it took a number of years to bring the right person into custody. Thank you, Jack, for calling in and for sharing that interesting moment. Bev is calling from Freeport, Maine. Thanks for listening, Bev.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hello.
Hi.
Good.
Tell us your thoughts.
Well, my thought was a memory that I had that's actually one of my strongest memories for me, not just around the Olympics, but in general. And that is, I was listening to a news broadcast, and it was a national network, I don't know which one, and a reporter was talking about Richard Jewell in the sort of time when he was...
Oh, I think, Bev, are you there? Well, I'm sorry to have lost you, but let's move on to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Tom, thank you for listening. What are your thoughts here?
Hi, I would like to ask your guests, at the time, I had heard an allegation that the FBI, against their protocol, had released Richard Jewell's name in order to put pressure upon him. I wondered if that was true.
Well, thank you for that call, Tom. So, Ken Alexander, you guys actually do some detective work and determine the source of the story that was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is what I want to turn to in just a few seconds. But it is sort of a reveal. So I wasn't preparing to reveal that necessarily, although this is a true story. You can decide what you want on that. But let me ask you, the question that Tom's asking in some ways go to the heart is it a tactic of the FBI or of some of its agents to release information as a way of trying to or leak information rather than officially announce it as a way of trying to flush out information or to raise pressure on a possible suspect?
Tom, I can tell you in this case, it was not a tactic that was employed by the supervisors. When Richard Jewell's name came out in the press, there was fist pounding all around. It went completely against the grain of what the strategy was at the time. So I won't get into the reveal, but I will tell you that both Kevin Sowen, my co-author, and I were shocked, as have been former FBI, Atlanta police, GBI agents, others, to find out who the leaker was.
It is a tremendous work of journalism there. I got to say, as a guy who's written a book, although it's been some years, I did do some 60 pages of footnotes. I would have wanted to actually go through and read yours had you done it. I know you did sort of more general descriptions of where you got stuff from. I'd be fascinated with that. Like, I'd want to know, just as a reporter, I'd want to know how you got certain kinds of documentation for some of the stuff you said. But you do characterize it, so it's not as though there's no transparency there. Let us turn Kevin Sowen to the question of the story. The late Kathy Scruggs was a law enforcement reporter, a really strong character, defining presence in some ways for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Metro staff, and she broke this story. Tell us, sketch a little bit of a portrait of her, and then tell us how the AJC broke this story at a time and how they presented it to the public at a time the entire national and in some ways much of the global press corps was not only focused on this issue of the bombing of the Olympics, but was present in Atlanta trying to chase that story as well.
Kathy Scruggs was a larger-than-life character. Someone had described her to us as living in Technicolor while the rest of the newsroom was in black and white. She dressed provocatively, always with one button open more than it should be. She was very attractive. She was a heavy drinker, a heavy smoker. She was profane. She kept a gun in her purse next to her perfume. And the cops loved her. She was extraordinarily well-sourced as a police reporter. And after the bomb goes off, many people within the newsroom are expecting they'll get a tie on this. In other words, it will be eventually a suspect will be announced or someone will be charged by the FBI, and they will be essentially equal to everybody else. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution will have that story when everybody else does. Mm-hmm. Kathy Scruggs kind of had a motto of, I'm not in the business of being last. And so she worked extraordinarily hard to figure out, okay, who is law enforcement looking at, and learns from one of her sources exactly who they are looking at, and that the lead suspect is Richard Jewell.
And so the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, as you point out, names him, and they say he has emerged as a leading suspect for this, and that federal investigators are focusing on him. And they do it, as you point out, in what's called in journalism the act of God, which is to say there's no comma according to three law enforcement sources we talk to or according to an investigator or according to, you know, two defense attorneys or whatever. There's no indication that anybody was spoken to. It's just that the AJC is doing this because, as you report in your book, they've basically promised their source they're not even going to name the agency or the institutional affinity that this person – affiliation that this person has in order to protect him or her. And she does this, and it of course becomes international news. this is something that's attacked by Jewell, by the attorneys he quickly hires, or not so quickly, but ultimately hires, and is ultimately something that he sues aggressively a number of major news organizations for. NBC News, Tom Brokaw, says out loud, I want to read the quote aloud because it's kind of incredible. He says aloud on the air, the speculation is that the FBI is close to, quote, making the case, unquote, in their language. They probably have enough to arrest him right now, probably enough to prosecute him. Of course, Jewell was never arrested and never prosecuted. That's three speculative words contained in there. CNN holds up a copy of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You know, a number of news organizations pay off Richard Jewell. They pay him for damages done to his character ultimately as the months and years ensue. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution doesn't. I want to play a clip from one of her colleagues. Her reporting partner, Ron Martz, spoke with the New York Times online video series Retro Report back in 2013. He robustly defended, as the paper itself did, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's decision to publish the news.
There's no way that anybody can convince me that we libeled Richard Jewell. The information we printed was that he was the focus of the investigation. He was the focus of the investigation. Am I sorry for what happened to Richard Jewell? Yes, I'm sorry for what happened to Richard Jewell, but I don't feel responsible for what happened to him.
Now, let me say also, Richard Jewell is no longer alive. Kathy Scruggs herself died in 2001 of an overdose of prescription drugs. And a number of folks in your book seem to attribute part of her deterioration to the aftermath of this story that had happened 5 years earlier. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution ultimately was upheld in court and found that what they published was substantially true, that the feds were looking at him and therefore they didn't defame him. They didn't wrongly treat him. From a journalistic standpoint, Kevin Saltwin, how do you feel about what the AJC, the decisions the AJC made in this coverage?
Well, first of all, David, there's no doubt that, as Ron Martz said in that clip, that Richard Jewell was the lead suspect for the FBI. What Kathy Scruggs learned and what the paper eventually reported was, for the most part, completely accurate. I think we can and maybe we should in this country have a discussion about whether newsrooms ought to publish the name of people who have not been arrested, not been charged. But the law in this country says that if something is true, you can run it in the newspaper or you can put it on air. And that's actually what happened with the with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. After that, though, is where things started to snowball, because this is very much a pre-social media story. If you think about it, there are 15,000 journalists in town. 1996 is this kind of remarkable year in journalism where CNN is already up and running, but you have MSNBC starts up that year. Fox News Channel starts up that year. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and a number of other publications go online for the first time. And so now, all of a sudden, the pace within newsrooms accelerates tremendously, and the public starts to become reconditioned to say, I want my information right now, right now. And this, what you end up doing is starting to swap out accuracy for immediacy. And as you can see, within our current social media environment and our current media environment in general, that has only accelerated since 1996.
Kevin Saltwin, you're talking about the innovations both of cable news and the competition in cable news for the first time that emerged in a few months after the Olympics with the surfacing of MSNBC and Fox News into full view, and also the sort of commercialization of the consumer-oriented World Wide Web, where suddenly people could post things online, even if it was relatively rudimentary to how we think about it today. Part of the problem with that first story, it seemed to me, was that they were incorporating some of the profiling language that had been given to them, I guess, by their most important source, although they had additional sources confirming that Richard Jewell was in the sights of some of these investigators, and also didn't attribute that. It seemed as though they were characterizing it and that the AJC was putting itself behind it. That said, the AJC, the Journal Constitution, then did some real reporting ultimately in the weeks that followed, casting doubt on that conclusion, trying to say, well, wait a second, could he have gotten from the payphone where the bomber was supposed to have made a threatening call to 911 and still been there in time to warn people away from the benches? And it seemed as though the AJC was doing some – taking some initiative as well to raise skeptical questions about that conclusion. Nonetheless, Kevin, at your newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, my sense is you guys were much more careful and much more protective of the idea of Jewell as a suspect deserving presumption of innocence rather than as somebody saying, that's the guy.
Well, you know, in the days and weeks after the Atlanta Journal-Constitution breaks the story and CNN makes it an international story, there were really two decisions that were made within newsrooms. One was to go the pylon route. So in other words, you had the New York Post running a newspaper cover that said Saint or Savage? Question mark with a picture of Richard Jewell. And they called him a failed fat sheriff's deputy. And they called him the village Rambo. And Jay Leno called him the Unidoofus. And you already played the clip from Tom Brokaw. So you had all of this piling on. There were several news organizations, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, leading the way on that, that were way more cautious. And then it wasn't until it looked like the FBI really didn't have enough for a case, or certainly wasn't publicly making a case, that you had publications like the Atlanta Journal-Constitution starting to lead the way in questioning whether Richard Jewell really was the guy.
And Kathy Scruggs was among those doing that. I have to ask, there's been a bit of a controversy, Kevin and Ken, each of you just briefly, about the movie that Clint Eastwood has directed and that you guys were consultants on, in which Scruggs is depicted as effectively trading sex for this initial scoop about Jewell. The actor Olivia Wilde has defended that presentation of Scruggs. That is not something that's included in your book. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote a story basically saying that never happened. How comfortable are you with that, the incorporation of that as an element of the story as presented in what's presented as effectively a nonfiction film?
Well, this is Kent. Let me start by saying the film is great. So I know both of us love the film, and I think they got the story in the main right, but it's not a documentary. So I think any based on the true story film that I've ever seen is just that. It's based on the true story. In our book, what we try to do, just putting all that aside, is just lay out the story as we found it. And Kathy Scruggs is a really colorful character. Olivia Wilde did an unbelievable job acting as Kathy Scruggs. And if there are differences or if there are some licenses taken, that just happens in movies, I think, a lot. And I think that's why people write books and like to read books, because you go to movies to be entertained and find out the general story. And in the case of Clint Eastwood, he's produced another masterpiece.
And Ken,
if you want to find out about the story, the book.
Ken, let me give you the last word for the last 30 seconds. To what degree does this episode that you guys capture so nicely and importantly reflect the kind of skepticism towards major institutions that we experience right now?
I think people look at government and they look at the media and they've got big questions because there are rushes to judgment. And one thing that we hope this book shows is when there are names that surface in the media or in an investigation, there's always a human being involved. And I hope law enforcement stops leaking and thinks twice before somebody leaks, and in the media before names start getting echoed out there. People recognize there's a human being.
You're hearing there from Ken Alexander, former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia. Thanks to you for your time. Also, thank you to Kevin Solwin, former Wall Street Journal reporter and editor. They're co-authors of a new book about Richard Jewell. My name's David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.